Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the OIS China Energy Programme. My name is Michal Maidan. I'm Director of China Research at the Institute, and I am talking to my colleague, Anders Hovey, who's a Senior Research Fellow with the China Programme. He has just written a new paper about China's clean energy innovation entitled Clean Energy Innovation in China, Fact, Fiction, and Implications for the Future. This paper will be available on the OIS website shortly, but today you are getting a preview of the contents of this paper. To timestamp this recording, we are recording on the 10th of June, 2024, and because events do move quite fast, even on the regulatory side of things with duties, investigations, and anti-dumping questions, I think it's important to know where we are in terms of timing today. So, Anders, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
And with that somewhat, I think, oblique introduction, could you tell us why you wrote this paper, why you think it's important and timely right now?
This is a big topic. The paper is about broadly innovation in the clean energy sector and how China achieved such a prominent and dominant position, not only within that sector, but within innovation in that field more broadly. It is sort of a long time period that the paper covers. However, I think it's highly relevant right now because even though many countries in the world have started to realize that they need to kickstart manufacturing in clean energy or else more climate-oriented policies will be difficult to promote as beneficial for their economies, I think that the manufacturing narrative has been picked up, but there are a lot of simplistic stories being told about how China does manufacture at such low costs and whether China has achieved its dominance through more copycat technology transfer as opposed to more innovation-oriented policies as well. So there's a lot of focus on, obviously, the anti-dumping investigations specifically tend to target the subsidy story, but also industrial policies that are adopted to reshore or friendshore clean energy manufacturing might not really have taken on board the full suite of instruments that China has used. And let's not overemphasize how well those different puzzle pieces might fit together in China, but might not fully take on board all the things that China has done to dominate not just clean energy, but innovation within these fields. And I think the second reason why it's important is that in this early stage of policies to reshore, friendshore, or kickstart domestic manufacturing and clean energy, I think it's very important to get those policies right. And we don't make any recommendations in this paper. It's purely about China. But I think one of the parts of the paper that I find most useful and most interesting, if you didn't read the whole paper, I would suggest reading just this section, which is that clean energy innovation in China has really been helped by the vertical integration aspect of manufacturing in China. And within that, the clustering of manufacturing in certain regions has played a key role, not just in reducing costs, but also on innovation itself. Those are the two main reasons why I wrote this paper now.
And it's interesting, right? We've had the EU parliamentary elections this weekend, and we've seen the Greens or some of the Green parties lose a little bit, as you were saying, dovetailing with this momentum in the EU, certainly in the US, to impose duties on China. But really, I think in the common narrative in the press, it's all about subsidies and the role of the state in China and really downplaying both innovation and I think not giving much attention to this issue of co-location of industries and manufacturing hubs. So the paper looks at China's dominance in the fields of solar, wind, batteries, and EVs, and again, how that dominance relates to innovation. So how do you think China's innovation really stacks up? I mean, there's a lot of talk about China can't dominate, and be it the political system that stifles thinking outside of the box, or what you were saying earlier about sort of copycat is the only thing that China can do. How do we know then that China is really leading innovation in these fields as opposed to just serving as this kind of low-cost manufacturer?
It is really difficult to measure something abstract like innovation. And I want to just say that there are a few common or popular ways to measure innovation, specifically in the fields that we are talking about. Some of those are focused on inputs like for example, money, R&D spending, and some on kind of outputs, like patent could be considered as an output. But I think that the best way to summarize innovation is that you do have to look at more of the whole picture, meaning all of those metrics and more, and not just looking at a single one. But still, those metrics are important. China has boosted its R&D spending as a share of GDP. So this is across the whole economy, includes government R&D, as well as private sector R&D, which, of course, difficult to compare apples to apples. So the fact that China has now approached the level of share of R&D spending in its economy comparable to the United States and the EU and ahead of some other major advanced economies, that is highly significant. But it's, of course, that doesn't necessarily say that how productive is that spending. For example, how productive is the spending within the clean energy or battery sector? I think that also the spending on R&D and the resources devoted to R&D, it is really taking place throughout the Chinese economy. It's not just at state-owned labs, not just at universities. It really is also at companies. And I think it's quite fascinating how the largest clean energy manufacturing companies, which may have started as purely low-cost manufacturers, so these are companies like Geely or BYD, that in addition to producing the most competitive low-cost EVs in the world, they also have just gigantic research and development budgets. And that even during periods when the industry is going through overcapacity and maybe slower demand growth, they are able to boost or sustain and even boost their R&D spending to stay ahead, not just stay ahead of their foreign competition, but actually to stay ahead of their domestic competition, which is very fierce. And then finally, in terms of the substance and the productivity of innovation, I think that it's fair to say that Chinese companies and these sectors more broadly are really at the center of the innovation space now. So for solar batteries, I think it's most obvious. And this is quantifiable when different analyses of patents have shown that the importance, the reference, international references to patents that are filed in China has put these technology developments in China more at the center of the patent field. And then, of course, we also see from discussion in trade press about and partnerships that companies, foreign companies, are making with Chinese companies because now technologies, for example, LFP, lithium iron phosphate batteries, where China is the leading manufacturer, even though the technology was developed outside of China, essentially foreign companies would need to partner with Chinese companies, not to get the low-cost production, but just to really gain access to the technology, not the patents per se, but the know-how and the ability to manufacture this competitively relies on the technology, the know-how at Chinese companies. And that really points to the fact that it is not just an artificial quantitative metric like the number of patents, which is not a good measure of innovation, but really the importance of the innovation in China shows. And, you know, it's really interesting how this dominance of innovation is often achieved by companies that were not initially known for being technology leaders. So, for example, Jinko, which was not started by a returning Chinese solar scientist, but rather by somebody who was expert in scaling up manufacturing and was really using a technology that was more conventional, crystalline silicon technology that was at the time not at the high end. Now they have the efficiency record through scale, through hiring scientists, through research and development spending, and through their integration with the whole supply chain. So it is not a R&D-led or innovation-led system. It is a whole integrated supply chain with innovation at its heart.
But it's interesting. I want to follow up on that. I guess one question is, how has this shift happened so fast, right? Five or even certainly 10 years ago, it was Chinese firms that were partnering with Western firms for know-how. And then it felt like really all of a sudden, or sort of post-COVID, the playing field had changed pretty dramatically. It seemed like a massive surge. And maybe it's just because we weren't watching closely enough. But how do you think this shift happened so rapidly? And perhaps related to that, you were saying that Chinese companies invest in R&D, even in moments of downturn and overcapacity. How does that fit into, again, what a lot in the trade press and in the EU and the US are saying about the unfair level playing field, that Chinese companies are more subsidized? Or, you know, how do we think about that competitiveness and that rapid change? Is it all to do with the government? Is it that they think differently? Or is it a combination of factors?
I only partially agree with the point about how recently this change happened. I would say for EVs, it's most apparent that the real ramp up in EV sales within China took place kind of in the 2020-2021 timeframe. But the dominance of batteries in China took a lot longer than that. And also for solar, although China was already dominant in the manufacturing of solar in 2010-2011, when some of those early anti-dumping investigations came along, China was not necessarily dominant technologically in solar and in the innovation field in solar. You know, that was the first field that China attained kind of manufacturing centrality, but not necessarily seen as a technology leader until, like, let's say, roughly the middle of the last decade. And it just sort of took that long for the whole supply chain to, for a combination of efficiency reasons and also through inconsistent policies outside of China and the need for, let's say, some technology companies that had run out of capital in the West were perhaps acquired in some cases by Chinese firms that were expanding rapidly during that time frame. And, you know, there definitely was an element of technology transfer, including definitely forced technology transfer, as well as, you could say, not forced, but strongly encouraged technology transfer through various policies that essentially pushed companies, foreign companies, to invest in localizing manufacturing and localizing their supply chains to China in order to gain access to the Chinese market or in order to simply sell their own parts into a Chinese manufacturer. A good example from an earlier time frame was the sale of turnkey manufacturing lines for solar equipment, where those manufacturing lines were essentially, China was the only customer for them because China was already on the low end of manufacturing, the largest solar manufacturer. Then once the supplied turnkey manufacturing lines were located in China, it was relatively feasible for China to build its own turnkey manufacturing chain and then roll it out more quickly. Speed is a critical element of the China success in these fields, manufacturing intensive, small modular devices such as batteries and solar panels, that where it's really the manufacturing where you need to be highly efficient and highly rapid at turning over that manufacturing capacity, as opposed to having a factory and amortizing that over 12 or 25 years. And I think that that does point to the role of subsidies to some extent. Many of the subsidies that do exist in China, I tend to emphasize that they are quite similar to the different subsidies in design that might exist in other countries. So good examples of those subsidies are the feed-in tariff, a very demand-side policy, as opposed to just subsidizing manufacturing. We are going to subsidize purchasing solar energy for use in the grid overall, or wind energy. So feed-in tariff was directly adopted based on a model from Germany or from Europe more broadly. And then similarly, in the EV space, there were mandates and quotas for the number of new energy vehicles that companies had to sell in order to have access to the Chinese market, or without that, they might pay a penalty. And that's directly adopted, again, from California, zero emissions vehicle mandate. Other subsidies directly to the manufacturing sector would be things like cut low-cost electricity, or the government will give you a grant or give you access to an industry park. Maybe they would pay the rent or give you some low-cost access to land, or even provide some free services like bulldozing a property so that you could build a factory there. Maybe that's not so analogous to something that would take place in Western countries, but it might be more analogous to a city or a state government, local government saying, hey, we're going to give you a huge tax break if you locate your factory here instead of over there. Another type of subsidy, however, that I think perhaps is a little bit less easy to document and quantify is the access to capital, the low cost of capital for manufacturers that are in strategic sectors that are targeted for expansion by the government. Here we have basically state-owned banks lending to favored sectors where they basically are looking, the banks are looking for signals, which are the favored sectors, so that when they make loans to those sectors, they feel confident that even if there's a downturn or a high risk in that sector, by offering a low-cost loan for expanding manufacturing very rapidly and being very nimble, you know, even if there's overcapacity, for example, in EVs, the banks feel that these types of loans and this type of capital will still be paid back and made whole, even in a situation where in outside of China, manufacturers might be thinking, okay, we need to show our investors, we need to show our banks that we are being capital disciplined. We are not going to expand production to gain market share. Instead, we are going to try to hold on to what we have and use our existing asset base so we can ride through this downturn. I think it's the opposite that takes place in China right now. Whether that's sustainable in the future, I think is open to debate, but I think that that may be some of the reason why R&D spending can still continue and upgrading of factories can still continue even in periods of rough sailing for an industry.
So I know this is a difficult one, but in the paper, you group the factors that led to China's dominance, and you talk about four main, I guess, buckets: government support, tech transfer, human capital, and entrepreneurship that go together, as well as these manufacturing clusters. And we've talked about all of these just now. Would you say that any of these were particularly dominant? Were any that stood out in particular? Obviously, in the West, we talk a lot about the subsidies or the government support. How would you, I guess, rank them in importance?
I still would say that policy is the most important factor. There's no way to quantify the importance of these four factors. And of course, the grouping into just four factors is also subjective. But I just would say that within the understanding that policy may have been the driving factor, I would say that it's not just subsidies is the important caveat to that. Basically, the consistency of policy. And again, here, I wouldn't overemphasize how consistent. I would say the relatively consistent policy supporting on an industrial policy level, as opposed to on a climate policy level, the expansion of investment and just manufacturing build out within these sectors. And that includes central government policy. It includes things that everybody knows about, like the 5-year plans and targets for how much solar capacity there should be, or targets for the new energy vehicle share of vehicle market. But those policies, I would say, may have been less important than the overall broader signal to provincial governments that if they support the expansion of industries in their area and localize technologies that are targeted by the state as basically the industries of the future, that will have long-term support. That not only catalyzes state-owned companies to give a second look at these technologies that they probably would otherwise not have looked at. So for example, wind and solar, where mostly the technologies were coming from private entrepreneurs who invested with risk capital and leapt in, often coming from other industries, as I mentioned. But then they would be selling their technology to the state-owned companies, which would build out that capacity. So you need both support for the entrepreneurs that are developing the technologies and scaling up manufacturing, the provincial governments to know that those investments will be supported, and the state-owned companies that ultimately will be either deploying the technologies or in many cases actually actively partnering with those entrepreneurs once the technology has achieved some level of scale. And definitely, I do want to emphasize the role of both entrepreneurs and risk capital and the massive base of scientists and engineers that China has now, both domestically trained and often returning scientists from abroad, but also the role of the state-owned players in actively participating in the expansion of these industries. So I would emphasize that all of the four factors are important. I would still put policy as the most important, but I would say that it is less direct than subsidies or 5-year plan targets or specific plans overall would imply. And it may be more indirect in terms of the signal that the government sends that investments in these fields will ultimately be rewarded.
I guess there's also the element of policy adaptation, right? At different points in time, you needed a different mix of policies. And from the West, we tend to look at it and think of the Chinese government as all-knowing, all-powerful, that has kind of mapped out the pathway to dominance in new energy supply chains. The reality has been a lot more adaptation and sometimes policy catching up with reality and catching up with what's happening in the market. So it's really interesting, I think, to think about these elements and, I guess, policy innovation to a certain degree when Western governments or companies think about their own efforts to nearshore, friendshore, recreate these supply chains. There are things to learn from China. I guess typically we think about human capital and entrepreneurship as really what the West excels in or has more of than China. How do you think about the private sector and entrepreneurship? There are a lot of interesting examples in the paper where you discuss some of the pathways of these entrepreneurs. How does that fit into the China story?
I think it really is an underappreciated aspect of the Chinese story. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly what the story is sometimes, because even when we have a success case from the West, we do tend to sometimes kind of turn our entrepreneurs into heroes. And those entrepreneurs themselves actively collaborate in that process of, you know, mythology around the entrepreneur and how much risk specifically they took relative to the contribution of a subsidy that they might prefer not to talk about, even outside of China. You know, the example of the role of the California zero emissions vehicle mandate in the rise of Tesla, for example, often not mentioned when we talk about the rise of that company. And the same thing is definitely true for some of these amazing entrepreneurs that, you know, founding companies like BYD or, you know, LDK or SunTech, the early solar companies. A lot of times they were coming back to China, or they were starting up in a new industry that they perceived as favored. In some cases, they might have actually been directly copying somebody else in their local area who had a successful startup. And then they were basically using some of the relationships with local government and with maybe state-owned industries in some cases, where, you know, some of the EV expansion has been directly enabled by the fact that local governments can leverage excess capacity at state-owned auto manufacturers to help startup companies produce EVs at state-owned factories. So there really is a complex interaction. And I would say that just like energy transition and energy, clean energy startups in the West, I think we would have to still think of them as very much policy driven, that is also the case for the entrepreneurs that have been successful in China. In addition, there has been a very strong role for policy. So we saw in, for example, the EV space, where there were some cases of fraud reported in the Chinese press, where subsidies had been paid out to companies that were not necessarily really using them to manufacture EVs or not to manufacture batteries. And so these subsidies had to be adjusted. And I think that the way that the subsidies were adjusted is actually really informative, which is that the government initially said, well, in order to gain access to subsidies for EV batteries, you need to show that 50% of the value is locally manufactured, and that's going to be our strategy for localization. And later, the government decided that that wasn't really going to lead to China being able to localize the full supply chain. So the policy was tweaked to say, really, the three key technologies within EVs, which are the batteries, the electric motors, and the control systems, all three of those really have to be produced locally. And the government even developed a whitelist of qualified recipients for subsidies, which was based on characteristics like energy density, other and quality performance of the batteries. And this list, you know, notably did not include any foreign companies that might have already been able to achieve those characteristics. And then, as you said, the policies evolve over time. So then once Chinese local manufacturers had achieved those characteristics, this whitelist for subsidies was abolished and a level playing field was established. But at that point, China had already effectively localized battery and EV technologies, so there was no need for such an aggressive policy. And I do think that that showed not only the learning from a policy failure within the EV space, but also what happened in the solar space, where Chinese government had seen that the initial part of the value chain that located in China was actually not the high value, and it was necessary kind of in the middle of last decade kind of really push the sector forward to localize the most valuable parts of the solar chain, even though China had already dominated solar overall globally by that point.
So let's talk a little bit about what I think of as the kind of unsung hero of all this, the boring bit, right? The manufacturing clusters, the vertical integration. We know that China is a manufacturing giant, and there are lots of industrial parks and bits and pieces and, you know, cables and nuts and bolts of every kind. How does this, you know, why is this important? Why have these been important also to innovation? Isn't it just an element of, well, scaling up and cutting down costs? How does it boost, you know, how is it in terms of efficiency? And again, how does it relate to innovation?
I think that when we think about manufacturing clusters, we think about efficiency, low cost, maybe the logistics costs. And I think that there's a lot of skepticism about the idea of manufacturing clusters. The very definition, it's hard to define what is a manufacturing cluster. So when I'm speaking about it, I generally am referring to it in the broadest level, which is more of a regional cluster, which might be different from the way that people even in China speak of manufacturing clusters, where, for example, one province might have hundreds of clusters, might be more of like a single industry park. So within China's manufacturing clusters, there's essentially the dominant clusters that everybody's heard about would be just the Yangtze River Delta and Pearl River Delta being the leaders of manufacturing, integrated supply chains within the battery, EV, and solar spaces. And, you know, those are vast geographic areas with huge populations, but also they're relatively close together, close enough together that there can be very easy sharing of knowledge. And of course, you have common language, but you also have the ability of suppliers of parts to not to the end user, the end consumer, but rather to the just a little one step downstream. All they have to do is, you know, get in a car, get on the train, and go maybe less than 1 hour to reach a factory and discuss, well, how is this part working out, or how many do you need and when do you need them? The integration has been critical, not just for efficiency, but for innovation, because the type of innovation we're talking about is not that lab stage innovation where you need a radical breakthrough in a solar material, for example, or a different battery chemistry, but rather you need to figure out, okay, this tool isn't working quite right, and we need to totally retool our factory anyway. Can you just give me the tool, but just slightly different or slightly larger for a new device that I'm designing here for my factory? And that type of process level innovation, it might literally be how we arrange the machines on the floor of the factory. That is more important in specific types of technologies, especially those manufacturing intensive technologies. So maybe the US and Europe have tended to believe that the highest value parts of the supply chain could continue to be dominated by Western countries, advanced economies, because obviously you have universities, you have this great education system, and many of the highest end, highest margin businesses, those that might be supported by venture capital, for example, would be more in the kind of like the software type of, you know, things that or pure novelty, new technology type innovations. But innovation in manufacturing might be more important for highly modular, small format, standardized, you know, large scale manufacturing is the key to lowest cost production. So yes, manufacturing clusters drive efficiency, lower logistics costs. The fact that maybe the cost of capital for building out a factory is also lower also contributes, but then innovation as well is helped by having these clusters. And, you know, you do see that very specifically from some of the interviews that other scholars have conducted within, for example, the solar sector, where initially the parts that came from the United States, the turnkey production lines that came from the United States or Germany, they were more efficient, they were better, they might have been even cheaper, but the speed of those types of equipment to adapt to the scale up that was taking place in China was not able to keep pace. So that clustering, and again, I would say that clustering is very controversial among academics who write about economics of manufacturing, but it does seem from what has been reported on the clean energy transition in China to have been very critical.
It's very interesting. I mean, the clustering element also, I think, speaks to this kind of feedback loop between the producer, the factory, and then the end user. And when it's all co-located, then you can very quickly adapt to tweaks, right? Not completely new innovations, but tweaks in also consumer preferences. And I guess it helps that there's a very large domestic market at this point. So you've got these manufacturing hubs and the co-location of industries, and the fact that a lot of these dovetail with consumer goods, where China is particularly strong and has taken a lead. And it reminds me, we were talking about this earlier, of the FT's podcast now, I think Tectonic Shifts, where James King talks about the electronics hubs, the manufacturing clusters that are very similar, again, where China leads. And there seems to be this sort of element of, oh, it's really surprising how China is now actually an innovator and not just a producer.
The electronic story is definitely a part here, where some of the vertical integration that took place within China was the realization by Chinese companies, and BYD is an example of this, where the company didn't start out making EVs, you know, started out in the electronics industry, and the companies, BYD being one example, realized that if they were only going to supply a part, they were unable to meet their customers' demands for quality and production without knowing how all the other parts worked. And so they actively sought within the electronic space to integrate vertically. And then they carried through with that policy when they turned to batteries and ultimately EVs. And then, you know, the local governments, I think, have also played a big role in encouraging this vertical integration. I think that, you know, the most common story that we hear in other countries is the local government went all out to bring in one big top brand manufacturer based on the number of jobs that were promised. They got X amount of tax breaks. Whereas I think the model in China tends to be more local government coming in and saying, okay, yeah, we're going to do that. But really what we're going to do is we're going to try to establish this manufacturing cluster and really actively bring in all the supply chain instead of just counting on the market to deliver that once the big company has been landed. You know, they're both the example of localization in China, where you have Guangdong province actually saying, okay, we're going to take an industry park and say, this is now a solar industry park. And if you're not in the solar supply chain, you're out. And we're going to force you out, and we're going to then offer your part of this industry park to parts suppliers who are active in this space. And you also have examples, for example, Fujian province setting up a patent review office in Fujian to review battery patents so that when CATL has a new innovation, they can quickly have that reviewed and approved by people who would be qualified. And obviously there's an ecosystem that goes along with that. Having knowledgeable people about batteries in Fujian would be critical for the whole supply chain, not just for one company. And then you also have the example of Shanghai, where they went all out to attract Tesla, even lobbying the central government to change the regulation on joint ventures to bring Tesla in. But it wasn't just to build a gigafactory. The purpose of the policy specifically was to upgrade the local industry, to force local EV parts and equipment makers to supply Tesla with good enough parts that would, you know, be of a high global quality that Tesla could use, to essentially encourage Tesla to use those suppliers instead of to vertically integrate back with its home market in the United States. And then ultimately that would enable tech transfer, not through stealing of technology, but rather through learning by doing, the transmission of know-how, and basically just upgrading the whole manufacturing cluster and the whole ecosystem in that local area.
I think, you know, again, from the outside, we look at China and we think about the impact on the EV markets here, and we forget just how fierce the competition is within China and how companies are really focused on beating their local competition, their domestic competition. And the secondary thought is the kind of international OEMs or the international markets. But it sounds quite formidable, right? There's a mix here of government support, of innovation, of scale, of a domestic market, both for the demand side and these manufacturing hubs. So when countries are looking at friendshoring, nearshoring, you know, recreating these supply chains, is it even possible? How do we think about, you know, is it about encouraging local content and tech transfers? Can other countries even do that if they don't have the kind of scale that China does? Do they need the manufacturing base? And also, how do we think about China's role in all this? And, you know, we've written a lot and talked a lot about this duality of China, on one hand, a really formidable competitor. On the other hand, if we open the markets, it's a huge contributor to a low-cost energy transition because of the availability of technology. So how do other countries think about this? Are there lessons to be learned? Is there anything that could be replicable or considerable or considered for their own experiences?
Yes, I do think so. Although I want to caveat that by saying that this is a study of China's success up to the present and not a study of other countries and how they compare. So I cannot jump in and rate the success of the Inflation Reduction Act or other policies. The advantages that China has, including those that you cite, especially the scale of the domestic market, those are also subject to change, and even they are undergoing change that could change the way innovation happens in China. There's, of course, a lot of pressure on the private sector as to whether some of the processes that led to so many returning scientists and entrepreneurs to start innovative companies that catalyzed some of these industries, those forces do appear to be changing in real time. And then the slowing growth in some of the sectors, you know, China is installing solar so quickly that I think most observers would say it doesn't need to even install as many gigawatts as it's currently installing to reach carbon neutrality. So the market will be slowing down domestically. How does that affect the pace of innovation? And how does that affect manufacturers who are competing with their domestic competitors? If they want to expand, they have to go abroad anyway. And if they have to go abroad, do they need necessarily to bring some of their technology and their know-how, just as those who wanted access to China needed to do the same, even without any trade policy or forced technology transfer? In terms of what there is to learn, I think I already pointed out the importance of clusters. And is it possible for countries, localities to deliberately develop such clusters? Because we know that many efforts to develop, for example, a local Silicon Valley, they've often fallen flat in the past. Even in China, there have been some failed efforts to establish industry clusters by some provinces that might have been just late to the party. Would other countries inherently be just followers instead of leaders in this field? You know, the answer is I don't know. And there are some early reasons to be very skeptical because, for example, in solar, where some of the efforts to remove some of the supply chain from China and maybe have some of this manufacturing taking place in Southeast Asia, that has not led to tech transfer. It has not led to higher parts of the value chain locating in Southeast Asia. Rather, it is really just disaggregation of production and maybe even just a few steps of production. Probably in the early phase, that would also be what would happen in a Mexico for EV parts or Morocco for batteries or again, Southeast Asia for solar. I would say that that is the start, and it would take many years and probably some very intentionally designed policies to basically bring some of the higher value parts of the supply chain. There would probably necessarily be some sort of domestic or highly local regional market for those technologies in order for such a cluster to emerge. And then would that cluster ever reach the scale that China has achieved in these technologies? I think that's very debatable.
And of course, we've got, right, it is a question of the policy incentives, the regulatory structure. We have the paper that's on our website on the US IRA and how the use of the foreign entity of concern, right, that's a punitive tool. That's more sticks than carrots and how governments think about this policy cocktail, I guess, or the mix of measures that would both disincentivize or de-risk from China, but then be able to encourage and maybe emulate some of the more helpful lessons from China. So we are very much at time, but I want to wrap up with, I guess, a forward-looking question. And you touched on this a little bit. You talked about China's scale and the slowdown potentially of solar deployment and whether that impacts innovation on the role of the private sector, a slowing economy. How do we think about some of the signposts or the things to watch out for? Is it a case of China's so dominant in this field, it's locked in now? They have first mover advantage, and I guess we should all just give up. I'm being a bit overly simplistic, of course. But how do we think about the outlook?
As in China, the outlook will depend on a mix of policy and the behavior of firms. In China, of course, includes state-owned firms, but also has included private entrepreneurs. Because of the very intense activity on the policy front to stimulate manufacturing in these clean energy fields, I think now the signposts we would be more looking at, what are firms saying about their strategies? Of course, all firms will probably tell a good story about how they are really looking to build up, for example, domestic manufacturing and have mastery of the supply chain. But are companies really looking to localize production and master many different aspects of the technology? Or are they still incentivized, in fact, to inform their investors and lenders that they are doing a good job of disaggregating production to achieve low-cost manufacturing in order to compete with China, which has that advantage still? Disaggregation to achieve cost savings continues to be the main corporate story for investors, even if people give lip service for, you know, the idea of localizing production. That might point to the fact that it's going to be more difficult or more slow to any way establish these manufacturing clusters that would ultimately not just help companies achieve mastery of a technology, but help another country achieve the type of innovation that would be necessary to keep up with China. because it's not just a matter of figuring out. And you do hear this a lot, like in China, the cost of a solar panel is X. If we could get it down to that or have a tariff as high as that, then we could protect our domestic manufacturing. That's, I don't think, the right way to think about it. The right way to think about it is, do we have the innovation chops to have the speed of innovation and the speed of scale up that China has? And I think it's pretty obvious right now that we do not. And so our companies looking at that as opposed to, okay, how do we achieve the $20,000 EV, you know, disaggregated production? So yeah, I think that there are a lot of questions and a lot of things to watch. And it's going to be very interesting, because right now I think we're in the midst of a very big experiment on this front.
And of course, that's one angle, which is innovation, leadership, and industrial competitiveness. There's a different, albeit related, angle, which is the energy transition and the speed and scope of that. But we have been, of course, discussing innovation in China. It has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you, Anders. I would also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us today. I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. You can read the entire paper on the OIS website. And as ever, we welcome your feedback and thoughts and look forward to our next discussion.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.